welcome to Board Game Binge, the place where we bring you bite-sized, bingeable board game content across the industry. I'm your host, James Staley, and in this episode, we're chatting with Andrew Stiles, co-host of the Tabletop Submarine podcast and the game designer of Wine Cellar, which is currently on Kickstarter. Andrew, welcome to the binge. How you doing, sir?
I'm always impressed with your voice acting there. You really you turn up the dial and you do a nice job. Excellent work.
You just gotta crank it up. I know I've had guests in the past saying, "Where'd this guy come from?" Because we were like so low key right off air and then bang on air. And you gotta bring it, man. You gotta bring it, don't you? So Andrew, welcome. We just officially met like 10 seconds ago before we went on air. But we have one of these things where we are in the same circles, right? So we know a lot of the same people. I wouldn't even say 6 degrees separation. This is literally 1 degree of separations where we have the same friends. Just you and I haven't connected yet. So this is way, way overdue. And I'm so happy and pleased to have you on, especially right now as you guys have a campaign that's live on Kickstarter. So we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But first... Yeah. As a game designer, as a podcaster, we're going to talk about how you got into all that. But first, how did you get into playing games? Where did game playing start for you?
It started, I think, pretty close to birth. My dad was a hobby level gamer, like really and truly. We had probably 200 to 300 hobby level games in our house at any one time. And they always kept going, stuff like that. But even as a child, there were a couple of things my parents believed in heavily. One was books. So we always had books. Two was games. We always had games and different levels of games. So I could grow up and grow into games as we did that. And so, that's some very obscure titles. And when I had friends in the neighborhood and they wanted to play games, they came to my house. We didn't hang out at their house and play games. We came to my house to play games. So I've been playing games since I was a kid.
And I think you and I are similar in age. And growing up, I mean, I was an 80s kid, right? There was no social media. Even back then, there wasn't really even video games, maybe like an Atari 2600. Literally, that was your entertainment, right? If you were bored, your parents said, go out and play.
Yep.
Or you pull out a board game, start playing a board game. Or we had a wall of encyclopedias over in the corner my family had bought. And you go and pull one of those out and start reading about something, right? Like that was your entertainment. And, you know, I look at this current generation, I almost feel bad for them that they don't have that same almost forced boredom where you had to, you know, find ways to entertain yourself versus just kind of picking up a phone and scrolling, right?
That said, I would have killed to have the resources to be able to go deep diving into whatever I felt like. Like I remember when I was a kid, I did like a report on killer whales, right? Like, and I remember having to go to like 3 different libraries to get enough books to get a deep dive into whatever it is versus pulling out my phone and just being like, okay, I'll get all the references immediately. So there is something. There is a bonus to technology, but yeah, I realized that in some ways, I think creativity comes from boredom and letting the mind wander. So yes, I think it's trouble for some people to not have those things or not be inclined to find those things.
I think there's a skill set too, right? Where you have to go and find answers. Like right now, literally, you can just open up your phone and say, tell me about killer whales to ChatGPT, and it's going to give you all the information on killer whales. And you can say, okay, go deeper. Talk to me about this. Talk to me about that. But kind of that classic example of going and doing research or keep hitting brick wall after brick wall and trying to find like answers. I think there's a skill set in there as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. And then like is game design, like, so you've played since you're younger. When did you get into like the hobby market? When did that kind of manifest?
I think I was kind of always in the hobby level of gaming, but then of course, you know, you get to be an older child and you're like, well, I'm done with that. I'm just going to be sports and be social and go to the thing. And I went off to college and kind of kept outside of that circle a little bit. And then, you know, you find your way in the world, you start finding your friends and stuff like that. And you solidify your social circles. And then eventually you start to say, I think I could probably introduce a couple of games to some people. And then you start maybe a small gaming group a little bit and it spreads out from there. And then, you know, I'm lucky enough that I met my wife later in life, but I still met her. And I remember taking her home to meet my parents, and my parents are gamers. So hang out at my place. We're going to play games. So we played, she knew I played games and we played a couple of board games together, but she didn't know the depth of what gameplay can be until you play 4 or 5 games in a day. with only breaks to eat or go walk around the park and then come back, like really and truly. So when that happened, I got that permission to like really go back into the hobby the way that I wanted to. And then we built a couple different game groups and went to game nights and we're to build my own collection back up again and stuff like that. So that's kind of where I went from that. And then, you know, the natural evolution is when you play enough games, you want to create the thing that doesn't exist. So
that's where I take that idea, right? That idea you have, and you say, wow, you know, how can I think I could probably, I've got an idea. Maybe I can turn it into a game using these mechanics that I just, played tonight at game night. I think it's funny when I hear people say that. I mean, I could totally relate when you're like, you know, having somebody that has played board games, I'll put that in quotation marks, it's like the Monopolies and the Risks of the world when they're younger, but they have no idea how deep and broad the hobby game industry is. I host a local board game meetup group here in my hometown. And about a month and a half ago, we had somebody come out who was like a slightly older than me, not that much older, but I was somebody who had played a couple games growing up and they thought, hey, that might be kind of neat, go to a social group. And everybody's pulling at all these different games that they've never heard of. And they're like, oh, this is actually a thing. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, this is beyond just a Monopoly. We're not in Kansas anymore, right? So but it's cool to see people kind of get hooked into it. I got a very close buddy who just started gaming about a year ago. He got into board game hobby, and now his collection of games is larger than mine. Like, he just went bananas, right? And just started collecting like crazy. And he's, you know, he loves trick-taking games. And, you know, he's trying to come up with, try to buy every possible trick-taking game he can get his hands on, right? Just so he can kind of fully immerse himself in. And I think that it's, I don't want to say it's an addiction, but I think for some people in the industry, it definitely gives them something to focus on, right? Allows them to kind of put their energy into something. And I think that's something that is positive, right? So instead of doing something that's just destructive, this is something that's constructive, right? You can use it to make new friends. You can use it to get some ideas. You can get it to exercise your brain. Like, there's so many positive things of the hobby, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a firm believer that games create a safe space for you to stretch your mind in different ways and also explore and empathize, right? Like, so when I play a game about colonization, obviously I'm doing the wrong thing and I'm being a colonist, right? But it creates that mental space where I can also think, what damage is being done, how I feel about this role that I'm playing in the world, and what would I do differently if this was actually a real thing, right? I think about that the same way that when you think about a movie or a book, you get to go explore that place and time. But games, it's different because you actually take an active role in it versus just passively hearing the story or listening to the story or watching the story. Yeah. You actually participate and you can change the course of way that goes. And now games reward you for doing specific activities, but it does create a place for you to start thinking about those things and maybe even having those conversations at the table.
No, totally. So I assume you're like a wine connoisseur too, or?
Yeah. So in my years of being in restaurant industry and hospitality and stuff like that, if you're a server for any period of time or a waiter, you know that the only way to make money being a waiter is to sell wine, like really and truly wine, cocktails, get to know all your stuff like that. And so it started with that. It just started me being better at my job at that time. And then once I kind of understood the depth and complexity and the interestingness that wine can provide, and then obviously most people don't know, I guess I shouldn't say most people don't know this, but wine and food is one of those weird handshakes that can really elevate both or it can negate either. Like, you can have a wine and the wine is fine and whatever, and it's just what it is. But if you have the right wine and food pairing, all of a sudden the food changes. So you have the food by itself, then you have the food with the wine. And it's like having two different meals at the same time. It becomes this really interesting and complex dance that's done. And especially if you ever have like a two or three wine meal, like where you have a couple different glasses and then watch the flavor profile of the food change with the different wines you're tasting. Anyway, I'm geeking out a little bit more than I probably should.
No, this is cool.
Once I discovered that, I started to actually like get into some formal training and like really understand what that's going on. and eventually got to the point where I was the person at my restaurant that they would come and ask questions to. Like the other servers would go, what would you pair with this? Or how would you with that? Or can you go visit my table and talk to them about wine? Because people are really serious and I can't keep up. And so I'd go over there and talk to them and have a great conversation. And then they would request me the next time they came in. They'd be like, I want to have that guy as my server and stuff like that. And so I became well known for that within my restaurant and stuff like that. And then I went over to hotels and I was a concierge for a while. And one of the things you do as a concierge is not only you make recommendations for restaurants, but I was doing my thing where I was actually recommending wine at those restaurants with the meals. I would recommend a specific plate and a specific pairing and stuff like that. I'd be like, you know, go have whatever you want to, but I think this is the best thing that they do. And if you're interested in having experience, that's that for you. And there was also a local supermarket near me that I went and scoured their wine collection. I came up with my list of like top 15 bottles they recommend if you just wanted to pick something up and come home at the bottle at night, hang out in your room and have a glass, you know, you're staying for 2 or 3 days, that's the glass or night, whatever night, you can do that too. And so I got this kind of reputation for doing that kind of thing. And yeah, so I love wine as a thing that accentuates your life and gives you new flavors.
Now, do you collect wine?
I have a wine cellar. Yeah, I do. It's a handmade wine cellar that I didn't make myself. I hired a person who's a craftsman to do, but I made it my way. Like I created it so that normally in a wine cellar, you put your bottles in and they stick out like this and you see just the tops of the bottle like this. I created racks where you could have a series like this with a stack and they line the bottles up and it goes top to bottom. And so I can see all the labels and I can see how much wine I have at once. And then I can go and say, you know, tonight I feel like a big bold red. So I go to this section where my cabs and my big Zins and my cab francs are. And then I go over here and I've got my lighter reds. I got my Viognier and my Vino Verdes and all different things like that. And so like, I got all these different kinds of things. And it's about the mood that I feel in that night or what we're having for dinner. So yes, I do have a wine cellar.
Now I'm sure anybody listening has got the same question I got. What is larger, your board game collection or your wine collection?
Oh man, my board game collection is probably bigger, but I also cycle in and out of it. And I try to keep it at around 200-250-ish versus my wine collection is constantly dissipating and needing refill. So it's not like I can't keep wine that long. Like we have a whole shelf of wines that are like special wines, like ones we really want to age and see how they grow and evolve and stuff like that. And so those rarely get touched, but the rest of the cellar is a constantly revolving door of drink, 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 go to the local wine shop, pick up 15 bottles, bring it home, stick it in the cellar and then drink, drink, drink some more. So yeah. And I say that in a way that makes me sound like I drink all the time. You know, it's like 2 or 3 bottles a week. It's not like we're drinking heavily, but you know, you have one tonight and you maybe have the same bottle the next night. And then you have another one the next night and kind of roll through. And then of course, when we go out to restaurants, I drink the wine that are at the restaurants and stuff like that.
So talking about wine. So you've got this game called Wine Cellar that 25th Century Games is currently got on Kickstarter. We've had Chad, the owner of the company, on our podcast, I think about 1.5 years ago. I know he's actually watching right now. He helped with some audio quirks that we had at the beginning there. We'll get that fixed later. But walk me through kind of how you came up. Obviously, I think the inspiration is clear. How you came up with Wine Cellar. It's a clever little game. Like, so I would call this a small box game, a quick kind of like filler game, maybe at the beginning of the night. It's an auction game, and this plays what, up to 6 players, or how many players does it play?
It plays up to 8.
8. Yeah. Wow. And then in it, can you explain, because I want to get into the math of it in a second, but can you explain to people who maybe have never heard of it, and I'll show on the screen here as well for people. Can you explain basically how you play this game or what this game is about?
Yeah. So essentially Wine Cellar is your rival sommeliers, right? And I make the cards so you don't have to know the information. So, but each card is a bottle of wine and each of them has its own little timeline. And I've got a couple of them right here, but you can also show on the thing. But there's rosé, red, white, and sparkling. So there's 4 different types of wine and they each have a country as well as a special timeline on them. So when you turn them sideways, you can actually see the timeline of value. You're going to take the cards from your hand. You're going to bid on them for the center cards. The center cards are the prizes for that round. And essentially what you're trying to decide is how badly do I want that bottle or how badly do I think you want that bottle? And that's going to depend my bid value that I put in for it. So what I want to do is I want to get the wine that I want but sometimes I want to let you win and then take the wine I don't want if I think you're going to take it, right? So that's the mind game you play with the game. When you put the cards down, you put them down face down. Once everybody has one down, you flip it over. Then you look around and see who has the highest number. They get to draft first. So they pick from the first bottle. Then the next person picks the next one. And so on the list. If you're the last, you take what's left over. You put that in your wine cellar. So you turn it sideways to get your timeline going. Then the next bottle you get from the center will then go either above or below that one. And then the next one above and below both of those. So we'll never go in between. You got to kind of like plan it out a little bit, but then also stack the best you can and make the best decisions as you go. Now you're also seeding those prizes because every card you bid with becomes the next prize in the next round. So then you bid again, and it becomes the next prize in the round again. And so you're constantly kind of planning ahead, making sure the thing that you're putting out is not only a good bid number for yourself, but also maybe something that you want or something that puts your opponent in a bad position. If I'm going to then follow up and make sure that I win the next one, I can put something you definitely don't want and kind of screw up your seller. You also have clients. And so your clients have different needs and wants. And so you're going to get different bonuses for getting their two favorite types of wine and also wines from the countries that they like and stuff like that. So there's this also deep little slightly meta game that goes on with, I need to find the things that I want while also trying to make sure that my seller aging process is set up. And at the end of the game, you're going to have, you know, your eight bottles of wine top to bottom, and the top bottle scores the first slot, the second bottle scores the second slot, third bottle scores the third slot, and so on down the list. So you get a score from that, and you get bonuses from your clients. And that's your score for the first round of the game. Now, people who are watching this are gamers, right? So they're not just people who are going to play a casual game of this. Sure. So in the gamer version of this, you have your seller, you get your score. Then the second round, you pick up your seller and that's your new hand. So in the second round, you have literally seeded the cards you have as your bidding numbers based on how you scored your seller. So you want to have a range of high to low or the highest possible, different kind of things like that one. But then you get a new client. And so it becomes this successive kind of roll through, and you play three games or whatever you play is what you want to play. But what's important in this game isn't just that you do all the gamery things. It's that this is the kind of game that while people are trying to decide what their bid numbers are, you can have a conversation. You know, like one of the things I like about trick-taking games is that you're focused, but you're not. I can have a conversation about how my friend's date went last week and whether he still likes the girl or he's moving on. Or I could talk to my other friend about how their gig went when they played the coffee shop with their guitar or something like that. You know, you talk about all the different things about life, and it doesn't have to be head down, focused, only pay attention to the game. And I created this game to do that kind of thing, but also to bring people into our hobby. Like there are tons of people out there who love wine, but have no idea that games exist. Or maybe they know about viticulture, but that's too heavy for them. Mm. They're intimidated by it. They can't pull that off a shelf, break it out and play it. I wanted something that would make people who are wine geeks say, yep, I can play that game. That's not hard.
It's super clever. I love this whole concept of your the card you bid with now becomes the cards you're bidding to receive the next hand. So it's constantly bidding. That forms the new auction that you're trying to get.
Right.
And how you place those cards. And I am simpatico with you on this. I love games where you can passively play and have a conversation. I think sometimes people lose a sight of, like, at least a lot of us get into this hobby for the social part of it, right? And when it stops being a social thing, where your head is down, you're so deep in a game, you're not really socializing, or you're trying to talk to somebody and they're like, hey, hurry up, well, you know, get your turn going.
Right.
For me, that's, I mean, my pleasure I get out of the industry is that socialization, making friends and chatting about these things you're talking about. So totally aligned with the game style. I think that's awesome. How did you come up with the math on this? And what came first? Was it the I want to create a game about wine, or was it, hey, I've got this very clever kind of auction mechanic I've come up with. Now I'm going to apply a wine theme to it. How did that kind of all come about?
It's a great question. No, I decided about wine. I think that was the thing. And then, you know, I looked at the games that were available in the wine market. Like it was Vinos, it was Viticulture, it was Wine Handler, stuff like that. But like there wasn't a game that I was compelled at or didn't showcase wine in a light that I liked. right? Like viticulture is kind of a winemaking game, but it's really a farming game. It's not about wine that's been actually made and then enjoying it, right? Like, so for me, one of the things that I knew and I kind of learned through the is how wine ages, right? So how it gets better or worse over time, and there's a breaking point where it goes downhill and there's a bell curve to it and stuff like that. And you want to age it, but only for so long. But for other ones, you can age as long as you want to. And so this was something that I thought I could bring to this hobby and then also make people who are wine geeks go, hey, he got that right. That's not crap. That's not whatever. And so the timeline thing was very early on. But originally, this was a trick-taking game. It was a game that I literally wanted people like grandmothers or children or people who didn't need to know about wine play a game and then bring wine into it. And there were all sorts of different suits and stuff like that. And eventually through playtesting, which is the only way to make your game better, you learn what works and what doesn't work and shapes and shifts and evolves and sweeps and changes and gets into where it kind of needs to be.
Yeah.
And that's where the auction part came in. It was a natural fit once it became that. And then I was like, I didn't know looking back at that point. The game became instantly better when I did that. And then the timeline started to work better as well. Now with the timeline, you asked about the math. So I could have done a ton of different things with this, but I really thought the best way to do this was to give each slot a 1 through 8 value. I thought very long and hard about whether I should have a couple slots with eights or, you know, maybe some people suggested maybe I do 5. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 5, 5, and then 3, 2, 1 back down, stuff like that. But I thought there was an interesting playing with the numbers that made sense when you can spread it out that way. So I could start to do things like 1, 3, 5, 7, and then go 8, and then go back on the evens on the other side. And I could do things where it gradual goes up and then tips out the end. And I thought it just was a more easily accessible understanding of how the scoring goes when you do that versus having multiple of the same number within a spot. It creates that thing about, well, it doesn't matter which one I put it into. Whereas if there's a spot that's an 8, that's the one you want, right? That's the spot you want to put it in. It's easy. And then also because it has that, 7 is the second best and 6 is the third best. It's obvious when you say it like that, but you have to play test to get to that point. Like all these things, when you see this final version, you know, this was play tested probably, it's going on now like 500 times or so. And it was probably at least 100 before I pitched it to Chad. So, I mean, I did a lot of play testing and it got a lot of tweaks until it got where it needed to go.
How did you and Chad connect? Like, where did that, like, how did that whole relationship come about?
So you had Daryl Andrews on the show earlier. He was my mentor when I was first bringing this game out. When I approached him, I wanted to make sure, one, the game was ready pitched, right? Like, and he conceded that it was, and he was very helpful that way. And actually the best half hour of my life was him having the conversation afterwards. He's like, okay, I played the game. It's good. Let's talk about publishers. And I was like, sweet. Let me get my pad and paper. Right. And he was like, you should check out these guys. You should check out these guys. And Chad was one of the names on the list. And so I was like, this sounds great. And he also did a game called On the Rocks. So he wasn't afraid of the alcohol thing. There are a lot of publishers who are afraid of the alcohol. So it's a turnoff for a lot of people because it is an adult thing. Even though this game has clients that you're doing the wine buying for, you're not actually consuming any alcohol, but that didn't matter to a lot of publishers. So Chad was smart enough in my brain to say, yeah, this isn't a downfall for it. And so I reached out to him and he said, sure, send me a print and play. And so I did. And then I didn't hear from him for forever. I want to say it was 6 to 9 months or something like that.
Wow.
I can't remember exactly how long because that's not how my brain works. I don't remember timelines. But yeah, he then sent me an email and said, my wife really likes this game. I think it's really clever. I think I'd like to sign it. And I was like, okay. So put it together and did it. And that was great. And I got that email like on New Year's Day. So that's how I started out my new year, was I signed my very first game. It was a great start to a new year. So that was great. So yeah, I really liked that. And then he and I have become friends. We've chatted a lot since then and we've made some tweaks to the game and we added in, it was originally a 2-player game. Then went to a 4-player game. Then we made it a 6-player game. And then recently we added in 3 more countries to make it 8-player game, because there's no games out there that do that. There's no games that are strategy games for an 8-player count.
Yeah, it was rare. I can think of one that we have under our portfolio, but yeah, it's rare to have that high of a player count, and it's a need that's more that's in greater demand. I mean, I go to game night. We had this game last night. We had, you know, we knew there was a bunch of people that were going to be showing up a little bit later, and we had a 7-player count. Well, okay, now we're splitting the group and we're doing 4 and 4 and 3 because all the games we had were maxing out at 5 players. Right. So the more you can have these kind of these games that are short play times that allow you to play a larger number of people, it becomes a staple in the game bag, right? When you're going to these meetups and these game nights. What blows me away is this is your first game that you've ever created, right? Like this is the first one.
It is, but I also feel like those many, many years of being integrated in the hobby without designing really set the tone, right? Like if you're a writer and you write, the more books you read, the better you are as a writer. So I really think that I've played probably hundreds of games that people in today's hobby have never even heard of, let alone don't know about. And also those games weren't as good as these games. So I learned about what I liked and didn't like and what worked and what didn't work way earlier on than most people get a chance to, because this is the benefit of playtesting people's games is you get to see games early on in the process and you get to watch them evolve. Right. And I feel like if you play a game prior to 1980, it's the same thing as playtesting, because those games didn't go through the rigmarole it takes to get to market than the games today do. So essentially I am a playtester of those games, and house ruling those games is an absolute necessity. You have to make those games better than they are. Otherwise they're not worth playing.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I always say this to people that are, you know, getting into the industry for the first time. They say, do you have any advice? I say, play as many different types of games as you can. Weekly, I am always on the lookout, and our gaming group very much does this. Usually someone will bring something that no one's played before and they'll teach it, right? So I try to learn a new game every week.
That's great.
And I am a way better game designer now than I was 4 years ago. And 4 years ago, what I had to rely on is I'd have to get people who had owned a lot of games, played a lot of games, and get them to weigh in on my game, say, hey, what do you think? And they had one buddy who's like 2,000 games in his collection. And he'd ram off like here's four different games this reminds me of. Or did you consider about, have you ever played this other game? Because I think if you incorporated that mechanic, it might work better. And I'm like, dude, I've never even heard of what he's talking about. Right. I haven't heard of any of these games, right? So the more you can play, the more rounded you'll get. And I frequently people will say, oh, I know James is out on this game because I know he doesn't like this game style. And I'll say, no, I'm still going to play. It's going to be painful, but I'm going to play because I know that I'm going to learn something. And just from that experience that I wouldn't have learned if I hadn't played the game. So I will force myself to even play things that are in a genre and a game style that I loathe purely to get the experience and the education from it. Right. So.
Absolutely. And I also say this, that, you know, you don't have to have a big game collection or people in your game group that have big game collections. Yeah. You can go to gaming conventions to do that. Like,
totally.
Yes, it's not frequently, but you can go, you know, 3 times a year for a weekend and have access to the library that they have. You can go watch videos the day before you go to play the game, learn how to play the game, and then literally just play it.
Yeah.
You can literally do that with zero. Well, not zero, because you have to pay for your hotel room and whatever travel thing, but you don't have to pay for those games specifically to have those experiences. And that's a great way to do that.
I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up Tabletop Submarine. I want to make sure we cover that quickly. So this is a podcast you're part of. How did that all come about?
So Josh and I, we are both game designers, and we were talking about what we could do to give back to the community, right? Like, what can we do to say, we're part of this. We want to create something that people can have for free that will entertain them in some way. I actually did a podcast before. It was called The Real Pour, where we paired wine and movies together and we talked about both.
Yeah.
And that ran for 3 years back when the Wild West of podcasting. It was like the first year in existence that podcasting was a thing. To the point where we didn't actually track metrics because we didn't want to pay for them. And there was no way to find metrics without paying for them. So we just said, screw whoever listens, whoever doesn't. And we didn't care. And so that got me the experience of doing this whole process. And then Josh was like, well, I think I want to do a podcast. Who was interested in doing that? I'm like, you know what? I'll jump on it now. Now I can do board games instead of, you know, the serious stuff. Let's go ahead and do that. And then we talked about what would be on it, right? Because there's tons of review shows. There's a ton of people who do like that.
Yep.
And that provides value to the publishers, but it's also a little bit selfish. Like, it's one of those things where, like, it's a take, share a little kind of situation. And I'm like, you know what doesn't happen that I get to experience and most people don't, is I go to these conventions and I listen to people having beers and talking, and they're trading stories. they're trading the war stories of the RPGs they played or the game bot can't stop or whatever. And they have these great stories that people around them start to pull their chairs closer to listening to the stories. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're like, oh, you were playing that. Tell me more about that. And so I was like, well, let's do that. Let's seek those people out who has those great stories to tell and make them share them with the world. And if they do, they can plug their show. They can plug their game. They can plug their channel. They can plug whatever they want to plug, but they have to give the content to the people that would normally wouldn't get a chance to access. You get behind the scenes stories. You get stuff that's going on in the industry with people who make or break the way the things go. Mm-hmm. On top of that, it was also a way for us to selfishly network, but network in a way that was unselfish, right? Like we were giving them a platform, a way to expand their reach, but also getting a chance to get to know them, get a chance to have a conversation with them, find out what they're about, find out what I'm about, and kind of spread that information that way. So that's what it came. And we're on a little over 2 years now, and we've got some really cool new guests lined up as well. We haven't made it through the entire gamut of people, so we have a lot more people to bring on the show.
Well, I'm almost at 200 episodes now, and I still haven't come close to going through the gamut of people. So there's lots of people out there to chat. It's a great podcast. And for those listening, if you like the Board Game Binge podcast, I know you'll love the Tabletop Submarine podcast as well. It's about an hour long format, perfect for if you're at the gym or maybe on a longer commute. Yep. And I just love the conversational style you guys have. So I would encourage people to check it out. It's awesome. So again, Tabletop Submarine. Where do you go from here? So you're a podcaster, you're now a published designer. Do you have another game coming? Are you going to do your own publishing? Like what's the plan for Mr. Styles?
Yeah. So our second game, I have a co-designer. His name is Jason Harris, and we have it with 25th Century Games, and it's about acorn woodpeckers. And Vincent Dutrait is doing the artwork, and I can't talk more about that than that because it hasn't been fully announced. But I'm very, very, very blessed that Chad liked not only the first design, he liked the second one as well. And then I have a couple other games that are more assigned than that, but those I can barely talk about. So one of them is a digging for dinosaurs. It's a dinosaur excavation game with 3WS. And those are the three I can talk about.
Amazing. Well, for those who want to check out Wine Cellar, it's currently on Kickstarter right now, 25th Century Games, as I said. I also want to mention, too, give a shout out that this isn't just the only game that 25th Century has on. It's actually a four-game campaign. So they've got Wine Cellar. They've got Sand Art, which I believe is Mondo Davis. Did that one? Mondo?
No, Mondo's is Big Sur.
Oh, his Big Sur. Big Sur, Sand Art. And then the Grand Skyport, is the fourth one?
Yeah. That's Dan Germain. He's also a Chicago area game designer. He's on the other side of Chicago for me, but he's pretty talented as well.
Oh, that's amazing. So great savings if people want to pick up more than one copy. I am going to put a link in the show notes so it's easy for people to find. For myself, I found it easy just by typing in Wine Cellar. You type in Big Sur, any of these game titles, it comes up right away. Andrew, I want to wish you all the best in this coming year. I know you guys got 3 days to go. I can't wait to see how this ends up, my friend.
Yeah, and I will also be at Origins demoing this. So if you're going to be at Origins, you can come over and find me, and I'll be showing Wine Cellar off to people who want to see it. But thank you for having me on. You're a great show, and I really appreciate your content. And thank you for doing what you do.
No worries. You take care, buddy. Cheers.
This has been an episode of the Board Game Binge Podcast, hosted by James Staley, produced by James Staley and Mike Bruner, with original music by Nick Smith. If you would like to watch these interviews live, simply subscribe to our YouTube channel, Board Game Binge, and you'll get access to live interviews, giveaways, and interesting board game content from across the industry. I can't wait for you to join us. See you next time.